show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Things are always a little more complicated out on the road. But I think I've got everything working, and we hope it continues to work for the foreseeable future. The foreseeable future being the next 2 hours and, 58 minutes and 20 seconds or so. Because this is Tuesday, the 27th of November, 2012. This is the Horn. It is Titanic Tuesday, named after the Titanic intellect on display from the right wing anytime they open their mouths. We are, of course, being sarcastic. Titanic Tuesday takes its name from something our buddy Jim heard one of the Titanic wits of the right wing say one day, the 972nd tier right wing talker over in Beckley, who said that there are fossils in the rock layers of the Appalachian Mountains of West Virginia because of the shifting of the Titanic plates. Yeah, really. The Titanic plates. So it only seems fitting that Titanic Tuesday should fall after Moran Monday. As it does. This is the Horn. This is the Head On Radio Network. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is the streaming home for the Horn. It's the easiest way to get the stream. If you're just sitting behind your computer, go there, click Listen Live, and bang, bang, there you are. But if you need some other means of listening, there's always TuneIn Radio, Tuner Internet Radio app for your smartphone, TuneIn Radio's app for your smartphone. There's Stitcher Internet Radio app for your smartphone. There's Dar.fm. If you get the, by the way, if you get the TuneIn Radio Pro app for a minimal fee, it also allows you to record the program, and that can come in handy. Kind of like DVR without the V for your smartphone. Little gang pulling together in the Head On Radio Network chat room. If you've never been to the Head On Radio Network chat room, this would be a lovely time to go. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom. It's not as complicated as it looks. It is merely a matter of selecting a screen name for yourself, selecting a password for yourself, and clicking enter. That's really all there is to it. And a really good gang of folks hanging out there. Our chat room moderator Sparky's there, Jug of Punch, Waggy's in there, Ecofer is in there. Heck, I'm in there. It's a good time all the way around. And the group will grow as the evening continues. Oh, hi. I'm Bob Kincaid. We are broadcasting live from the headquarters of the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Campaign in Washington, D.C., on Capitol Hill, just a stone's throw, but don't throw them because there's a lot of people with guns around here, just a stone's throw from the Supreme Court of the United States. It is gray. Night is falling on the nation's capital as we speak. What appear to be possibly snow clouds are skidding across the skies as the evening ritual of the commute home begins. And we are working on getting more signatures on the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, the AKE Act. It is presently designated H.R. 5959. It will get a new number when it's refiled in the new Congress. But it will provide, oh, Lordy, it will provide relief in Appalachia that has never been known. Because it suspends new permits for mountaintop removal. And it monitors the health of people in communities near it while the old permits continue. And then once a full study is done of the cause and effect harm that it appears mountaintop removal causes, no one will ever be able to do it again if they cannot prove they will not harm a single solitary soul living near it. The AKE Act was not conceived by a bunch of people who proclaim to be our voices, who don't even live anywhere near the devastation caused by mountaintop removal. The AKE Act is not used as a fundraising vehicle to support the salaries of people who have nice livings and paid vacations and health care and things like that. The AKE Act is of, by, and for the people who are tormented daily, hourly, by mountaintop removal. And it has a better chance of ending mountaintop removal than anything that the people who say they are our voices, those geniuses, have ever done. And I mean that seriously. So go to ACACT, ACHEACT.org. Learn more about the AKE Act. Look at who's sponsored the bill so far. And odds are, your member of Congress has not. When you find that your member of Congress has not, contact them. Contact them once a week, if need be. Tell them to get on the bill. Tell them to be a part of the relief of Appalachia's agony. And agony, it damned well is. And don't be afraid. If it turns out that your congressperson is a Republican, don't be afraid to contact that Republican. Just today, I got a nice note from Kevin in Colorado Springs. He's got a Republican member of Congress. He's not afraid to call persistently, telling them that he wants Representative Doug Lamborn on this bill. You might recall that Representative Lamborn was the one who had a hand in calling the Capitol Police on our AKE campaign team colleague Maria Gonneau when she tried to show a photograph of a child bathing in the water that is the effluent end product of mountaintop removal. So, nonetheless, Kevin picked up the phone, and Kevin dialed Representative Lamborn's office and said, I expect you to sign on to this bill because it has all in the world to do with the rights of the unborn. There are things about the AIC Act that it will appeal to Democrats and liberals and progressives. There are things about the AIC Act that will appeal to pro-life Republicans. If you really care about babies in the womb, it is impossible to go on supporting a practice that subjects them to enough toxins to make it 181% more likely that a baby in the womb will develop respiratory birth defects, 181% more likely than a baby born to a mother who smokes in an area where they don't have mountaintop removal. I will ask a favor of you. And I will... It makes our job here a little easier. If you do contact your member of Congress, shoot me an email, Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, @gmail.com. Let me know that you have, in fact, contacted your member of Congress. And then we will act on your contact. Can we do that? I sure hope so. Oh, goodness me, Skype is improving my Skype experience. Well, that's good, because we didn't have a very good Skype experience last night. But I think we did sort out last night's problem. And last night's problem had a little bit to do with the fact that I had screwed up and had two versions of the same account of Skype running on different devices. That is now taken care of. There's only one version running on one device, and everything should come through just fine if you try to reach me at the Skype handle. Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, H-O-R-N, Bob Kincaid Horn. I am signing into Skype right now. And Jim is asking for more volume. I don't know if I can give you any more without completely blowing the thing up. This thing, unfortunately, Agnes, this one doesn't go to 11. Maybe that helps some. Hope it does. Skype is up and running. Bob Kincaid Horn is the contact address. Okay, yeah, I'm seeing that in the chat room, too. Sound a little low. Sounds a little low, Bob. Is it better now, Sparky? Okay, good. That's very odd. This is supposed to be a really, really high-quality, sensitive... Yeah, sometimes it ain't. Yeah, Toussaint's a tav. But it is Titanic Tuesday on the Horn, and the Horn is a... Yeah, you know, it's a little ongoing experiment in seeing if we can create a different kind of radio. You know, instead of the kind of talk radio where the caller calls in and says, "Magadidos from Busted Knuckle... The Wyoming Rush, I just love you and want to chew your toenails off." Well, that's enough about you. Let's talk about me. I hate that. Instead, we try to have what we call conversation radio here, and it has been made entirely possible over the years by you and by your kind contributions. Now, we find ourselves this evening... moving in rapidly on the end of November, in about a $470 hole from being able to complete our fundraising for this month. And it's a simple matter of fact that when we get in a hole like this, it makes the next month particularly difficult. you know, the last 2 months, our good buddy Scott in Sweden has actually had to pony up on his Beat the Swede challenge. And it's looking like he may be safe this month. Because he kicks in an extra $100 every time we meet the monthly goal. Now, this isn't the recalculated monthly goal that was occasioned by suggestions from our buddy Tom in California. This is the $2,500 goal that was based on my bad math. And we are about $470 or so. You know, that's 48 people at $10 a piece. But that's how far we are from closing out November and being able to claim that you have once again beaten the Swede. It also calls the next month of broadcasting into question, or the month after that. Just saying. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So, too, is the snail mail address, which is under the tab Contribute at headonradionetwork.com. And I do want to extend special thanks to everyone who has been a part of each month's fundraising, because any way you slice it, this is an amazing process. There's nothing, we're not supposed to be here. I remember when Ed Schultz referred to people contributing to keep radio on the air. I remember when he referred to that as bake sale radio and said it wasn't really professional. Yeah, let's see. What's the phrase I'm looking for? Oh, yeah, F him. Yeah. I've also been thinking, because I continued to get email through the evening last night and into today. Apparently, Ron in Raleigh touched a nerve. And I don't necessarily mean in the negative. Ron sent in a Moran Monday nomination last night for this claim that Tom Hartman is apparently making, that atheism is a religion just like any other. And a number of you wrote in to say, no, not really. And I have to agree. Because I got to thinking about, what if you applied, you know, atheism is the unwillingness to believe in an invisible, all-knowing, all-powerful creature that no one has ever seen, touched, or in any wise measured by any of the means by which we can sense things. And that's saying that there's not one because there's no evidence of one is not the same as a religion that says there is. For instance, no fire. Let's say you got a big campfire over here, and over here you have no campfire. No campfire is not just another kind of campfire. It is the absence of a campfire. No sopping wet elephants is not the same thing or another kind of sopping wet elephant. The absence of poison is not another kind of poison. Not having candy is not the same thing as another kind of candy. I think you see where I'm going with all of this. Well, much better for some, not so good for others. Sorry, Andy. He says, thanks, you just blew my eardrums out. This is what happens when we leave the home studio. Thank you very kindly, very, very kindly, Eco, for getting us started this evening. Gary just wrote in. He said, I've been listening for quite a while now, but have been unable to support the program due to an accident that left me unemployed for a good while. Well, I'm back at work and would like to offer a matching contribution for tonight for up to $75. I appreciate all you do for the health of your community and in keeping us informed and entertained. Thank you, Gary. He says, you're a good man, Bob, and it's a shame you're up against the wall every month. I look forward to continuing my support in the future. By the way, I also love listening to Sandra and Kevin. Your grateful listener, Gary, from New York. Yeah, that's how it works, Gary says. I'm not sure how this matching thing works. As I understand it, if my pledge can entice others to contribute $75, I will also contribute $75. Is that right? That's right. Everybody else kicks in $75. Gary kicks in $75. And that would be a humongous help. So, are we square on the fact that atheism is not a religion? Do we understand that? Do we understand that the absence of pajamas is not a different kind of pajamas? Because, if you buy into atheism as just another religion, then the parable or fable of the emperor's new clothes is lost on you, too. You know the fable. The emperor was so powerful that no one would dare criticize him. And a new tailor came in and, for a vast sum of money, claimed to make him the most fabulous clothing in the world. The only problem was it was invisible. And no one would dare tell the emperor that his new clothes were actually a matter of him being naked. Until somebody spoke up and said, Mummy, I can see the royal tallywhacky thingy. Right? The absence of clothing is not another kind of clothing. And I'm at a damn loss to understand how, to figure out how somebody can't quite grasp that. Robert in Australia. I hear you fine here on the other side of the planet, Australia. For everyone else, turn up the volume on your speakers, or turn them down. Thank you, Robert. Marty does dissent. He says, I think where Hartman was going with his comments is the feeling behind the belief. Someone says there's a God. More later. Okay. Well, I mean, this is not a criticism. It's just this thing, this notion, and the right wing has been preaching it for eons. Well, you know, them secular humanist atheists, they just got a different religion, and they're trying to make us all be their religion, and their religion ain't got no, they ain't got no Christmas. They hate Christmas. They ain't got no Easter. They ain't got no bunny rabbits running around laying chocolate eggs in commemoration of the dead guy who got up. You know? But apparently this topic really has some resonance. Tamara just wrote in. And she said, thank you. Every time I have the atheism as a religion too argument, I hope it is my last. No luck so far. And from smart people, too. Logic people. Tamara says. Well, maybe that's the way we go about it. Nakedness is not a different kind of clothing. Starvation is not a different kind of food. Well, one can darn sure hope. And, of course, there's a link to all of this. Isaac in Ohio just reminded me of something that I actually, it was a tab that I already had open. Do you know
that here, in the year 2012, of the common era, it is possible to be put in irons, to be conveyed to the custody of a county sheriff in the Commonwealth of Kentucky for not believing in God in 2012. You know, every time some right-winger fulminates about the Taliban, I think somebody should be there with a little copy of this story or this statute, better yet, rolled up and just whack them gently in the head with it and say, you want to talk about that religious intolerance a little bit more broadly there, brother, pastor, doctor, representative, cornflake? No, it's true. You can go to jail for a 12-month term in Kentucky for not believing in, and we're not really sure whose version it is, of the invisible friend who loves you so much that he prepared an everlasting lake of fire for your eternal torment if you do not accept the sacrifice of the rape child that he had murdered because you were born carrying the sin of a woman who ate a fruit 7,000 years ago. Oh, I get lost. You would think this thing would be taken care of by now, but it hasn't been. No. In the state of Kentucky, they have a statute. They have a statute that addresses their State Department of Homeland Security. And the Homeland Security law in the Commonwealth of Kentucky requires that a sign be posted at every Kentucky Homeland Security office that states that Kentucky cannot survive without the favor or love or protection, or from the way this looks, extortion of God. Here's what the law says. The safety and security of the Commonwealth cannot be achieved apart from reliance upon Almighty God as set forth in the public speeches and proclamations of American presidents, including Abraham Lincoln's historic March 30th, 1863 presidential proclamation urging Americans to pray and fast during one of the most dangerous hours in American history, and the text of President John F. Kennedy's November 22, 1963, National Security Speech, which concluded, for as was written long ago, except the Lord take the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. Hallelujah. Amen. The law requires that plaques celebrating the amazing power, there's power, power, wonder-working power in the blood of the Lamb. Yes, yeah, I won't do that to you anymore. The law requires that plaques celebrating the wonder-working powers of Almighty God be installed outside the state Homeland Security building. And whoever don't put the plaque up faces 12 months in jail. The text of the plaque is even dictated. The safety and security of the Commonwealth cannot be achieved apart from reliance upon Almighty God. who got this through the laughable Commonwealth of Kentucky legislature? Why, it was Baptist Minister Tom Reiner. Anybody want to guess his party? You lose. He's a Democrat. New York Times asked him about the law, and he said, "The church-state divide is not a line I see. What I do see is an attempt to separate America from its history of perceiving itself as a nation under God." And bless their hearts, American atheists are still trying to get rid of this monumental piece of deistic rubbish, theistic rubbish. People can believe whatever they want, but you don't get to send somebody to jail for a year for not. You just don't. Which brings me to a little excursion on this Titanic Tuesday into history. I was just cruising around the Twitter sphere earlier today, and I ran across a blog post over at a wonderful blog that I browse occasionally called Lawyers, Guns, and Money. And it's an excursion into American history. It's a little Sherman set the Wayback Machine for January 1848 kind of piece. The young Abraham Lincoln, 39 years old at the time, had pretty much come nigh to destroying his political career by daring to speak out against James K. Polk's war of aggression against Mexico. It was that war that came to its conclusion in September 1847. It was the mid-19th century equivalent of George W. Bush's slaughter of Iraq. The Mexicans never had a chance. They had also not done anything to earn us making war on them, except that James K. Polk saw a potential real estate deal there that might provide some economic relief by the way of free land. So Eric Loomis is writing over at Lawyers, Guns, and Money in a piece titled John C. Calhoun and How American Boundaries Were Restricted by the National Commitment to White Supremacy. Now, work with me here. You're going to see this all just ties off with a real pretty little bow. Eric Loomis gives a little rundown of the history of the war against Mexico. Started in 1846. We wound up stealing, by way of what was later negotiated as the Gadsden Purchase, the northern half of Mexico, which included California, New Mexico, and Arizona, and a little bit more. Everything of the western part of this continent that wasn't the Louisiana Purchase. The war culminated in the Battle of Chapultepec, a beautiful, beautiful park that had existed in the Valley of Mexico since before the arrival of the bloodthirsty white people. It had been the strolling grounds and burial grounds of the Uitlatoanis, the revered speakers of that people. It had parklands filled with magnificent, ancient, thousand-year-old cypress trees. And naturally, being Americans, we blew the shit out of it. And we brought the Mexican government to its knees at the Battle of Chapultepec. after which we extorted the northern half of Mexico. You know, part of that countryside that teabaggers are constantly hollering about, we need to make English the official language here. These damn people need to learn to speak English. They're Americans now, right? So, there was a question then, after we had conquered Mexico, about, well, why don't we just go on and finish conquering? Let's just make it part of the new United States, dadgummit. Let's make this all one country here, the part that ain't Canada, because every time we try to cross that parallel up there that makes the Canadian border, they whoop our asses real good and hand it back to us, and we got to run back home feeling not so good about things. Yeah, the Canadians will whip your ass if you mess with them. We learned that on a number of occasions. So there was some talk about maybe making Mexico part of the new United States of America. And for a while there, it kind of had some currency. Except for it didn't sit real good with Senator John C. Calhoun of South Carolina. And suddenly, a land-grabbing freak like John C. Calhoun didn't want no Mexico in no new United States of America. For many of the same reasons that bother the Republican Party to this day. Calhoun, of course, was in his day a Democrat. Today he would be a Republican. John C. Calhoun, Eric Loomis writes, stepped into the fray to give his opinion about why we couldn't annex all Mexico would upset the nation's racial balance. Oh boy, here it comes. Get the popcorn. He delivered a speech to the Senate of the United States on January the 4th, 1848. These are the words of John C. Calhoun. By the way, the same John C. Calhoun who argued that slavery was a positive good. Not just an evil to be tolerated, but a positive good for everyone involved. Not just the slave owners, but the slaves. Because, you know, in the course of the brutalities of the Middle Passage, well, they'd gotten here and they'd been exposed to Christianity and they now had saved souls that were going to go up to heaven. Now, mind you, there would be a darky heaven up there and a white folks heaven, but, you know, it's heaven. Right? But on January the 4th, 1848, John C. Calhoun said the following to the Senate. The next reason which my resolutions assign is that it is without example or precedent whether to hold Mexico as a province or to incorporate her into our union. No example of such a line of policy can be found. We have conquered many of the neighboring tribes of Indians, but we have never thought of holding them in subjection. No, never. That trail of tears. Nah. Never of incorporating them into our union. Now, we put them on a reservation on useless land that really will barely sustain human life, and good luck with all that. They have either been left as an independent people amongst us, or been driven into the forests, you know, or the deserts. John C. Calhoun was not the most intelligent of men. I know further, sir, that we have never dreamt of incorporating into our union any but the Caucasian race. Jesus, it just sounds, the minute you hear Caucasian race, it sounds like a Klan rally, doesn't it? Especially with that cracker-ass accent. I know further, sir, that we have never dreamt of incorporating into our union any but the Caucasian race, the free white race. To incorporate in Mexico would be the very first instance of the kind of incorporating an Indian race. For more than half of the Mexicans are Indians, and the other is composed chiefly of mixed tribes. Mixed with what, there, the Grand Dragon Calhoun?
I protest against such a union as that. Ours, sir, is the government of a white race. The greatest misfortunes of Spanish America are to be traced to that fatal error of placing these coolid races on equality with the white race. That error destroyed the social arrangement which formed the basis of society. The Portuguese and ourselves have escaped. The Portuguese, at least to some extent. I guess he didn't know about Brazil. And we are the only people on this here continent which have made revolutions without being followed by anarchy. And yet, it is professed and talked about to erect these Mexicans. Well, Dr. Freud, now leave me out of this fun. This guy's too over the top. I ain't touching it. Okay. To erect these Mexicans into a territorial government and place them on an equality with the people of the new United States. I protest utterly against such a project. Sir, it is a remarkable fact that in the whole history of man, as far as my knowledge extends, there is no instance whatever of any civilized coolid races being found equal to the establishment of free popular government, although by far the largest portion of the human family is composed of these races. Yeah, I guess he missed that whole part about how Tenochtitlan was the largest, most successful, cleanest city in the entire world before it was blown all to smithereens by those superior white folks from Spain. Yeah. Kind of missed that whole Inca civilization that built Cuzco, Peru, you know, where with the stones that we still don't know how they moved them, and the darn things sit through earthquakes and don't fall down. No, not nothing near as civilized as them white races that couldn't even clean their own butts enough to keep from getting the bubonic plague there in your 14th century. White people. And even in the savage state, we scarcely find them anywhere with such government, except be it our noble savages, for noble I will call them. For they, for the most part, had free institutions, but they are easily sustained among a savage people. Are we to overlook this fact? Are we to associate with ourselves as equals, companions, and fellow citizens, the Indians and mixed race of Mexico? Sir, I should consider such a thing as fatal to our institutions. The next two reasons which I assigned were that it would be in conflict with the genius and character of our institutions and subversive of our free government. I take these two together as intimately connected, and now the first, to hold Mexico in subjection. You know, when you learn history, you approach it with a certain degree of optimism at least one point in your life. And then you find this. And you realize, no, we've been beset by morans for quite a while now. And you think of the words of, what was the name of the bad guy in A Good Man is Hard to Find by, not Eudora Welty. No. That's a hard man is good to find. Anyway, no, there was a bad guy at the end of the short story, A Hard Man is Good to Find, and he was called the Misfit. And just right after he'd got done killing the loudmouth granny who got everybody in trouble in the first place, he said, you know, she might have been a good woman if there would have been somebody there to kill her every day of her life. And, what was the author? Anyway, but no, she's making a point. She's not espousing violence.
She's talking about that some people just can't be good. Church won't make them good. Religion won't make them good. Nothing makes them good. I mean, hell, John C. Calhoun was through the church doors every time the church doors opened. What was his plantation wound up eventually being the ground upon which was founded Clemson University. And I use the term university loosely. In that great struggle, I find myself a South Carolina fan. I mean, you got to respect a school whose athletic slogan is "Nobody licks our cocks." Really? I'm getting looks from Agnes. They're the Gamecocks, Margie. Yeah, I mean, I've seen the T-shirts. Yeah, I've been to the games. Yeah. Yeah, do your show, Bob. But no, John C. Calhoun was through the church doors every time they were opened up, and you still get this kind of stupid that I was reading to you there. We are unaware of anybody quite so wonderful as us white folks, even though our Savior was a little bit on the dark side, you know, if you know what I mean. We grandfathered him in. Now, Dr. John and I were talking about this article earlier. And Dr. John read the article and said, "Oh, that's just lovely. American. Oh, I hate this computer." Display driver stopped responding and has recovered. I'm so glad you're feeling better. I'm not. No, Dr. John writes, "Oh, that's just lovely. It really is stunning how much of our American history turns on the related questions of, one, how can we stop non-whites from having sex with whites, and, two, how can we get more non-whites for the whites to torment, and, three, how can we convince poor whites whose social and material circumstances are the same as non-whites that their interests actually align with rich whites?" It's really, says Dr. John, no wonder the rest of the world looks at us with such horrified fascination. Yeah, we are. Culturally, we are the slow rolling train wreck that the rest of the world just stands there and goggle eyes at. And we still can't, you know, we killed 600,000 people 150 years ago trying to sort this out. Ever since seeing the Lincoln movie and starting to read Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals, I've reached a conclusion. Historically, we talk about the beginning and ending of Reconstruction. Well, that's bull. That may have begun and ended as a governmental program, but we're still at it. We are still in Reconstruction. It could be that we're not even in Reconstruction. We haven't even tried yet. Oh, thank you, Don. He says, "Hey, Bob, RIP Warren Zevon. I like it when someone offers a challenge. Count me in for $20. How do I do that again? It'll be on PayPal. Keep on keeping on. Don in West Tennessee." Oh, Lordy, I'd love to hear from West Tennessee. Do you realize, the Southern listeners to this program, do you realize how shocked people are from around the other parts of the country and the rest of the world when they hear you on this program talking progressive, talking liberal? Do you realize what a lie you put to ignorant books like Whistling Past Dixie and that recent book, Hey, Let's Secede the South? Because you do. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. Don, it's real obvious. You click it and it'll take you and you just do it. Thank you. So that means we have taken a big chunk out of Gary's challenge, which is a huge help as we go toward the end of
end of this month.
But no, like I said, I told you I would put a pretty, okay, it ain't going to be pretty. I was probably lying about that part. But I told you that I would put a bow on all of this. Let's see, February's 2, November's 11. Yeah, it was a little less than 9 months ago when George Goodshootin' Zimmerman blew away a 16-year-old young man for the capital crime in Florida of having a hoodie on and carrying Arizona brand iced tea and some effing Skittles. Here we go. This time, the story is one of Jordan Russell Davis. It's another story from the Stand and Blaze state of Florida. It's almost too much to tell. Jordan Russell Davis. Was 17 years old. Yes, I said was. And he and some of his friends were sitting in an SUV in a parking lot, doing what teenagers do, you know, listening to their music. Not bothering anyone. Well, meanwhile, a man named Michael David Dunn, 45 years old and vice president of Dunn and Dunn Data Systems in Vero Beach, Florida, had traveled to Jacksonville this past weekend for the wedding of his son. And it was this past Friday when Michael David Dunn pulled up beside the vehicle in which Jordan Russell Davis was seated, along with several other teenagers, and told them to turn down their music. And I guess Jordan Russell Davis dared to backtalk the white man. That's when Michael David Dunn pulled out a firearm, a pistol, and pumped 8 or 9 rounds into the vehicle and into Jordan Russell Davis, 17 years of age. He was in the back seat. No one else was hurt. He was unarmed. Well, except for the fact that he was armed by his blackness. Because, you know, in the white bread, lily white Castile soap world of the Michael David Dunns, blackness is frightening. God. Young Jordan Russell Davis died in the arms of one of his friends in the car.
at least this time through, Mr. Dunn was charged with a crime without having to be hunted down for it. He was arrested at his home on Saturday, charged with murder and attempted murder. He's being held without bail. And his lawyer says that he felt threatened by the unarmed black teenager after having driven up to them to tell them to turn down their music. And that's why he felt it necessary to stitch a few rounds across. Young Jordan Russell Davis. Nothing changes. It's Florida where you can stand and blaze. You know, he did, Dunn had his answer all handy. Well, I felt threatened. I wonder how long it'll be before the National Republican Rifle Association issues some sort of statement on behalf of Mr. Dunn and his sacred Second Amendment rights to keep and bear arms to blow away frightening black people. Because it's coming. Sure as God made little green apples, you know it's coming. Wonder how long before some sick Klansman, some sick teabagger, posts something like, "Nice shooting, Dunn." America, 2012, where the wheels turn, but no real journey is taken. This is The Horn, HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. It's Titanic Tuesday. I'm Bob Kincaid. Your calls are welcome. We're going to take a little break and come back. The Green News Report is on its way. Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. And when we come back into the second hour, you can join in on Skype. I think we've got everything sorted out now. Bob Kincaid Horn is the handle to connect to here, because we are on remote in Washington, D.C. at the headquarters of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. The AIC Act. The AIC campaign. Chime in, then. I look forward to the conversations. We'll take a break and come back. I'm Bob Kincaid.
It's Tuesday, November 27, 2012.
We haven't done as much as we need to.
Another round of UN climate talks begins in Doha, Qatar.
Now, once the feedback starts, it's irreversible. It'll also persist for centuries.
New study warns that permafrost is melting. Plus, ALEC mobilizes to kill clean energy.
All of that and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
At Doha, here, we'll sketch out the next steps in a process for developing this new agreement.
Yeah, sure you will. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Des, the burning question as the UN Climate Conference gets underway in Doha. Is the country pronounced Qatar, Guitar, Gutter?
Well, what is it? People from the area tend to range between Qatar and Qatar, so I go with Qatar.
Why does Fox News call it Gutter?
Because that's actually more closely accurate to the Arabic pronunciation.
And Fox News is known for its accuracy. What do you have for us today?
Well, first, the U.S. domestic clean energy industry is under attack at the state level. The Washington Post reports that the Heartland Institute, a libertarian think tank skeptical of climate change, has joined with the right-wing American Legislative Exchange Council, known as ALEC for short. They're getting together to write model legislation to repeal state laws requiring utilities to get a portion of their energy from renewable sources. 29 states have legally binding renewable energy standards. Those boost incentives for clean energy from non-polluting sources. ALEC and the Heartland Institute both receive funding from the fossil fuel industry and have come under heavy criticism for their efforts in recent years to undermine environmental legislation at the state and federal level.
Wasn't the Heartland Institute the one that was working to change children's textbooks to include climate change denialism?
Yes, they were. And they were also the ones earlier this year who put up those climate denier billboards that likened people who understand climate change science as equivalent to Charles Manson and Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber.
Yes, I recall that as well.
The next round of United Nations climate talks are now underway in Doha, Qatar.
Here and in the future, governments must stick to the tasks and timetables that are necessary for an adequate response to climate change.
For the next 2 weeks, delegates from the UN's 193 member countries will push through the next phase of negotiations for an international climate treaty to reduce emissions of heat-trapping greenhouse gases that cause global warming. That treaty would take effect in 2020. Again, as in previous years, the primary divide at the conference is between developed and developing countries. Who will go first in cutting emissions, and by how much? Rich, already developed countries have benefited historically from their past emissions. Developing economic powerhouses like China and India are reluctant to slow their growth, and the poorest countries are struggling to lift their citizens out of deep poverty. The irony, of course, is lost on no one that Qatar is the first member of OPEC to host the annual climate talks. U.S. Envoy Jonathan Pershing reiterated the United States' position that any new agreement must include all nations. Citing the political climate in the U.S., he has resisted pressure from developing countries at the conference to commit the U.S. to steeper cuts than those already announced by President Obama.
I do not anticipate that the United States will, in the pre-2020 timeframe, modify the commitment that we have made in the political context for something approaching, in the context of legislation, 17% below 2005 levels by the year 2020.
You know, Des, we cover these UN conferences every year. Is there any indication that they are any closer to an actual agreement that could actually be signed here in the United States?
Well, what tends to happen at these conferences is they wait to the last minute to make actual progress. This treaty deadline is until 2015, so there might not be any visible progress until then. As a backdrop to the conference, grim conclusions in two new reports released in conjunction with the negotiations. The first report calculates that current worldwide worldwide emissions mean that current cuts pledged by member nations will not be enough to meet the agreed-upon limit of global temperatures rising no more than 2 degrees Celsius. The report says the world is on a path to see a 4 degrees Celsius temperature rise in coming decades. And a second, more disturbing study indicates that permafrost, the frozen ground that stores massive amounts of greenhouse gases, has already begun melting due to rising temperatures, says lead author Kevin Schaefer of the U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center.
Now, the available projections of future climates don't include the permafrost emissions and don't account for the permafrost carbon feedback. If these projections had included the permafrost carbon feedback, all those temperatures would be shifted upward, which means that any emissions targets that you based on available projections might be too low.
So all of the startling scientific reports from the UN up till now predicting global warming have not included the warming that would be caused by the melting permafrost?
Right. They did not have the data at the time. Now they do.
So it could be worse than even they think.
Exactly.
Wow. For all of that and more, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. And remember, you can download us anytime via iTunes, listen to us on your mobile device via Stitcher Radio, find us and like us, please, on the Facebook, and follow us 24/7 on the Twitters at Green News Report. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Yes, indeed, hour number two. We're kind of figuring some of this stuff out as we go along. It's kind of difficult to take Skype calls while we're running a break, because in this setup, they're on the same channel. So if you tried to call in, do feel free to try to call in again. We can only take one call at a time. So that's how that works out.
Yes, and Agnes is helping Bob, and I'm not touching anything.
And you're talking about yourself in the third person here.
I know. You make me do that.
Yeah, 20 years. 20 years. I know. That's how it goes. This is the Horn, and it is the second hour of the program. And if you do want to get involved, you know how to do that, right? The Skype handle is Bob Kincaid Horn, and I trust that nobody's having trouble getting through anymore. So. Fire it up and come on in if you are so moved. By the way, a little bit of housekeeping. Tomorrow night's program is a game time call, and I say that because I'm not entirely certain as to whether we'll be here. We might have some evening work that has to be done, and in that case, the rerun stream will kick over. And Ben Birch is taking care of the rerun stream right now. So just tune in. I'll try to give some advance warning on Twitter and Facebook. But, you know, I'll try to be here. But we're not entirely certain. Let's do indeed go to the phones. I think we have Sandra. Are you there, Sandra?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you indeed.
Oh, okay. Listen, so what is the deal with... John McCain, is he having some sort of mental breakdown?
Yeah, I think we are seeing I don't know, the sad part of the end of driving Miss Daisy with it, you know, driving Senator crazy with John McCain. He's just not home. It's like the Aricept darts aren't hitting anymore.
Well, it's just, you know, because he just has this ridiculous, you know, a hard on for this Rice chick, you know? And he's just sort of, it's just hideous to watch. I'm like, I'm not a big fan of hers, but, you know, it's all really starting to just be, I can't think of anything except for him being some sort of racist sour grapes, you know?
I think he's crossed some threshold, Sandra. His ability to tolerate persons of color has come to an end.
Yeah, no, it's definitely seemed to be, you know, because I don't know what else to say, because it's not rational. So when it goes, when it veers to the irrational, well, racism is quite easy to look at, because that definitely isn't rational. And she answered all their damn questions, and it's like, well, what else do they want, you know, at this point?
I don't know. I think they want her to admit that something that is wholly that they have imagined. I think they'd waterboard her if they got a chance.
Well, Petraeus already said, you know, what was going on. From, you know, he's like their savior, so she's saying the same thing as him, but yet she is the one being, you know, her reputation is being destroyed. But that's always okay for black people. Their reputations don't matter, unlike him and all the other white men who are coming after these folks, you know?
Yeah. And, of course, I love what Charlie Pierce, how Charlie Pierce refers to Senator Lindsey Graham.
Oh, Huckleberry Closet Case?
Yeah, Senator Huckleberry Closet Case.
OMG, yeah.
Yeah, who is the natural and just undisputed apparent successor to John C. Calhoun, of whom we were talking a little bit ago. Yeah, I'll put a hold on anybody. I won't tolerate it. You know, I think it's about time we get somebody find those very special photographs of Senator Huckleberry Closet Case and circulate them. You know,
well,
I mean, if he wants to try to extort the White House, then, you know, game on, right?
Yeah, because
Little Rent Boy has got to be out there somewhere.
Oh, no, I'm sure quite a few of them. But like I said, I have my own issues with Rice. But I think that I've noticed that the White House seems to be willing to, expend some political capital on her. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see if they're going to back down, because it's like one too many black folks now is starting to look really apparent, you know?
it's becoming ridiculous, Sandra.
It's kind of like,
again, you know, I think it needs to be reiterated. I remember most of our calls, and I don't think anyone would ever suggest that you are that you've got the secret decoder ring and certificate suitable for framing from the Susan Rice fan club.
No, I think she's a cruise missile liberal of the highest order who, if she became Secretary of State, will have interventions all over the fucking planet. But that notwithstanding, I'm sort of just looking at the process, and why is there such the double standard can only be too many Negroes in positions of power, and these cracks can't deal with it.
Well, do you see within this context, Sandra, why I'm saying that we've never even done Reconstruction. if we'd done Reconstruction, we wouldn't have had to have had Brown versus Board of Education in 1954.
To listen to these white freak senators, you would think that this is an episode from Birth of a Nation. You know that when they have all the Negroes in the legislative house. I mean, you know, what are we dealing with here?
it's hard to avoid that impression. No, and you know, the question is this thing has become an entire tableau of abject silliness.
Well, that guy, that writer, the journalist who sort of was shut off on Fox, that was hilarious. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like, I can listen. That never gets old. Okay, thank you.
Click. Hey, where'd he go? I guess we lost him. Next. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't, you know, I'm not even.
But the question I'm getting at, Sandra, is, was there any suggestion? Because I had read a bunch, I'd heard NPR reports, I'd read news articles, you know, even before the election, talking about who would he select? Who would Obama select for his new cabinet? And everybody said, no, Susan Rice, no, probably not. But through some sort of political puppetry, have the Repiglicans put him in a position where he has to nominate her now?
Well, there is an element of that, just because, you know, various quarters are sort of solidifying and, you know, pushing that, I think. We'll see, though. I have no idea. But, I mean, she has like a, you know, A-plus rating from AIPAC, so what else does she need to get in there?
I'm at a loss.
I mean, she, you know, she's good to go. That's what I'm saying. I mean, she is not... Yeah, so, I mean, she ticks all the boxes for, you know, Israel supporting. She vetoed every possible resolution ever came up in the 4 years she's been in the UN. So, you know, I don't know what the problem is except for, oopsie.
Yeah, she's just, she's just a little too, well, you know.
Dark. But anyway, I'm not even going on too much. I just think that the whole thing is just, McCain is looking crazy. That's all. Like he really needs to sort of take a little step back and resign. But, there's other things that are more disturbing to me, like the way that it's come out now that these, cretins were rushing around trying to codify how we can kill up people because they're worried about what a Republican president might do. Do we need to bust out the Madison, Bob? Do I need to bring out the Madison again?
You know, it might not.
Does Obama think that he's one of those angels that Madison said don't exist?
You begin to wonder, don't you?
Because he's talking crazy, like, oh, somehow we'll make this killing people, we'll get that right. So any president upcoming can go ahead. No. Once we are doing this now, as far as I'm concerned, the experiment is effectively over.
It sure seems that way.
Because everyone's being okay, including people on quote, our side, about this codification of killing, murder.
And you know, there are so many layers of objectionability to this. If this was the United States Air Force doing this, it might be a different story. Maybe it would be too nuanced, but it might be a different story. But this is the CIA engaged in a killing program that they won't even acknowledge. You know, kind of like Israel won't acknowledge that it has nuclear weapons, but everybody knows it. The CIA won't acknowledge this program.
No, but the problem that we have to, you know, besides all the poor unfortunates who are going to be taken out, is when that shit comes here, back home.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
When they start, you know, they'll come up with some justification. Because I don't think people realize, I mean, that is the nature of what we're dealing with here. We have allowed a sitting president to do killing without holding him accountable. I mean, that's sort of the basis. Now he's designing a program that allows for this sort of warfare to go on, where you are able to decide, we're going to pick this person, and they have to die with no due process.
And no, not even so much as a star chamber.
Except for do you, because we can. That's, there is no international law at play. That is Hobbesian. And when you become weak, somebody going to come and do your ass. That's why you have international law. I don't mean to make it simple, but that's about it.
Well, it is, and you know, we're talking about people with long memories. There are people in the, and I'm not, what is the name? I can't remember the name of the blog now, but if you look on my Facebook page, our buddy Horst sent me a blog post, I think, 2 days ago? Just a brilliant piece of writing, in this case, about Israel, and about... you know, the Israel's future with a United States and EU in, you know, kind of unavoidable decline. And you know, he asked the question, you know, what happens then? And I think that's kind of the question that you're getting at. What happens when somebody else gets drone technology and starts deciding to take us out?
Well, that's, I mean, and that's the thing about the post-World War II, you know, hegemonic regime that we put in place. You know, we were at the top of it, or we're at the top of it, but the U.S. had a pretense of designing international law. So we weren't Athens. We were supposed to be something else.
Right.
But right now we're back to Athens. And we all know what happened to Athens.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not rocket science. This is world history empire 101.
Cyclical behavior. I hold to the brief that empires behave, whether they want to or not, in a certain evolutionary fashion. And I think you're getting at the same thing. By the way, the name of that report is the name of that blog is the Archdruid Report.
Oh, okay.
It is brilliant, and this particular post is in the Twilight of Empires. And you know, he asked the question, "What happens when the United States and Europe can no longer prop up Israel?" Because we do. And it is an absolutely masterful and brilliant analysis. But in that America that he presupposes, that declining America, what happens? What is our defense when somebody else flies drones over us and decides to hellfire, you know, a wedding? Will it not be a matter of the chickens having come home to roost?
Well, yeah, but I think that, you know, going back to Israel, the mention of Israel is more of a, can be easily become a proxy of what could go on as the U.S. declines, because Israel can easily be sacrificed. They have been before. This is why for Israel to be acting the way it is, I really shake my head, because I'm like, dudes, you don't think the U.S. will cut you loose if shit gets real crazy here? I think so. And Israel is going to be in a world of trouble.
I don't know how you come to any other conclusion. And at which point, you have to ask the question, what in the hell is going on inside Bibi Netanyahu's head?
Well, the same thing that must be going on in that idiot in Egypt, because he forgot where the hell he was, too.
Yeah, it's just...
He's decided that, the West has, elevated me because of my gibberish with the peace treaty, and I think I'm just going to go Mubarak and take all kinds of power. They got people doing pitchfork fighting, rioting in the streets again in Egypt because the Egyptians are like, oh, wait, what? You see, this man thinks he can just...
Well, see, it means something when the aggrieved poor of Cairo and Alexandria start referring to the new guy as another pharaoh.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying it's, power just completely corrupts. And, I mean, I understand that Morsi is under a lot of pressure with the IMF, the military, the U.S. But he went through an election, so he has to acknowledge some democracy. Hence,
yeah, he has to acknowledge the structure that put him where he is.
Right, and he's not, because dissolving the judiciary and saying, oh, I need to do this to weed out whatever because of the leftover, that's BS. That's what Mubarak did, and 30 years later, you see?
Yeah, oh yeah.
It's the same kind of power move. I mean, that's why, you know, people are going buck wild in Egypt now, because they're like, we've seen this movie.
Oh, I do have to ask you, Sandra. Did you happen to see This Modern World, Tom Tomorrow, and how General Petraeus made Droney sad?
No, I haven't had a chance to look at that. I have to check.
No, you're so gonna love it, because one of these killer drones is a character in his drawings now. His name's Droney. Kind of the way Mr. Butts, the cigarette, was a character in Doonesbury.
Oh, right.
Yeah, this is a beautiful thing. He shows up at the window. Droney flies up at the window of General Petraeus. And he says, "General Petraeus, sir, it's me, Droney. I just got back from Pakistan. you can scratch a few more probable militants off the kill list. Also, their neighbors. And he notices that General Petraeus is not his usual exuberant self. He says, sir, what's with all the boxes? Are you moving to an even more prestigious office? No, Droney, I had to resign. You see, there's been a scandal. And Droney says, oh, no. I always feared this day would come. Did Americans finally take notice of the creeping militarization of the CIA? Have they risen up in outrage against our lack of accountability, our refusal to even acknowledge the drone program, let alone explain who we were killing in their name and under what oversight? And then there's a blank panel, and then Petraeus says, oh, actually, I put my penis somewhere I wasn't supposed to. And Droney just says, humans are weird, sir.
I wonder how long he's going to run that series for. I mean, he can conflate that with all kinds of madness.
Oh, but it's so true. You know, this is a nation that ho-hums about extrajudicial killings of God knows how many human beings, one-third of which have been signed off on by the president and two-thirds of which have not. But, you know, let the human put his penis somewhere he wasn't supposed to, and, well, we can't have that. That's a sign of an empire descending into absurdity, isn't it?
Well, especially in face of, you know, the latest nightmare that's, you know, that I've done some drilling on, is something called, some sort of, methane caltrate, some sort of exploding methane that's gonna bubble up. Because of the melting permafrost, I'm like, you know what? That climate shit seems to be really nearby, and not in a good way. Because it seems like if we have all this madness going on with the U.S., but the climate thing seems to be kind of happening really quickly.
You know, they're still touting that 4 degrees Celsius rise.
I heard it's, you know, they talking it's 6 and shit, and that the, you know, the Arctic may be completely ice free in the year 2016.
Yeah.
And then I discovered, unfortunately for me, the whole idea of the feedback loops. And I was thinking, oh, my God, what is this? So apparently, as it's melting, the ice is not only melting on top of the glaciers, but huge rivers are being created underneath
them.
And sort of melting them underneath. And then you have what was white that reflected is now dark, and it's just making...
And absorptive.
It's making the seabed warm, hence... The bubbling methane.
Jesus Christ.
Well, which,
meanwhile, BP is... What? Bubbling methane? Can we get there?
Oh, no, but I mean, it's just a whole notion, because I was just looking at the sort of time scope they're talking about. They're saying that changes that are happening in the last 100 years took, like, 30,000 years before... we're doing what happened in 30,000 years in 30 years.
Yeah, we are literally
crazy sort of situation we're in now.
Well, you know, the world is going to be getting together in Doha, Qatar, very soon to address climate change again. And of course, we're somewhere around useless or yet less than useless on it. But at least somebody's calling us out. The number one United Nations diplomat for international climate negotiations is Christiana Figueres, Sandra. And she's gotten a little bit hateful. She said, first, from a domestic perspective, why would the United States allow other countries to pursue the technologies of the future while the United States stays with the technologies that are becoming every day more obsolete, hence losing its future competitiveness in an increasingly competitive world?
Well, if there's no... you know, if we have Sandys every other day, you ain't gonna have to worry about it.
Well, that's the truth. But you know? the answer to that question is because ExxonMobil and Shell and BP and Chevron own us. I mean, we need to understand that on a very, very deep level. and personal level. Everything that we want out of our country, Sandra, everything we want in the way of a future, every hope we have for our kids, our relatives, whatever, is compromised by the fact that we, our culture, and even our own ability to respond to crises are owned by the oil conglomerates.
Well, this notion that that we have to make these multinational corporations keep their reserve, which is what they're basing their value in the ground, is, you know, is blowing my mind. You know, this is just something that unless you pay attention, you don't even begin to understand. And I'm not even sure I even understand it. Apparently, they have, their value is based on their reserves. They have a certain number of barrels, let's say, in the ground. And in order for us to keep from turning this planet into Pluto, we gotta have them keep all that shit in the ground before we get to a point where the climate change is irreversible because of these feedbacts, which would be out of our control. Am I about right with that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. It's why the tar tar sands have to stay tar sands and not get melted and gooed down into something that can go through a pipeline to Houston where it can go to China.
Okay, and do I also understand that there is a few tipping points where you get into uncontrollable climate change?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so
I mean, when the feedback, you know, a feedback loop, anybody who's ever made a mistake with a mixing board like what I've got here and had feedback,
yeah,
you know, it just and pretty soon you feel like your ears are splitting.
And those systems are, that's in a lot of systems, and yeah, of course.
Yeah, and that's why it's a feedback loop. It comes back to itself, it builds on itself, and it comes back and builds and builds and builds, and it spirals. But it's not like, it doesn't spiral tightening. It's like a tornado that's narrow at the bottom and broad at the top.
Okay, and so another thing that I've read is that Jim Hansen and some of these other scientists, they're all sort of talking now as if what their models were wrong, and it's far worse than what the sort of 2-degree people are talking about.
Right.
That's out of the window. That's not possible.
Yeah, that's why I was saying that, you know, that's why I mentioned that 4-degree Celsius line that they've been talking about for so long. Most of the people who are serious about this say that, no, that's probably not likely anymore, and we're talking about a rise above 4 degrees Celsius, in which case all bets are off.
Yeah, I thought that 3 degrees is, they think, could be, you know, when you start approaching that kind of irreversible situation.
Right. Well, did you see the story out of Maine about the newscasting team who quit on air?
No.
They were a long time, much loved, much respected newscasting team, and they didn't tell anybody they were resigning. It was a man and a woman. They weren't married or anything. But they both realized that they had gotten to the point where they couldn't tolerate it anymore. And so they resigned on air in the middle of the broadcast so nobody could do anything to them. And then they started issuing statements about why. And one of the things they pointed out was that the guy who was the general manager was totally inimical to any reporting on anything relating to climate change. And they pointed out an email that he had written like back in 2006 in which he had told that had been obtained by the New York Times, for God's sake, Sandra, in which he said, no more global warming stories. There will be no more global warming stories until Bar Harbor is underwater. And went on to say something about, you know, the science is not at all confirmed. It's certainly not a total agreement. You know, this is a dispute, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, what the disservices that are being done by these people who feel such a fervid degree of fealty to these godforsaken oil companies is astonishing. I mean, are they secretly printing the tickets to the Logan's Run Dome, and everybody's got tickets except the ones who don't, and we just don't know there are tickets at all? I mean, where are these assholes in Bar Harbor going to live, Sandra?
Well, I mean, you know, I have to think that because this, what we just talked about is, you know, sort of unbelievable, hard to comprehend, which means you have to have a international global response, it's sort of antithetical to their worldview.
I mean, what is Barbara Bush going to do when there's 4 feet of, when there's 4 feet of water in her boudoir and she can't find the pearls she usually clutches?
And we know she'll probably still be alive in 2060.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I expect her
she'll
to be
140 walking around. Yeah, for sure. But no, I don't know. I don't. You know, I just sort of, you know, been just reading and listening to some different reports about the whole climate situation. And I'm sorry, that situation sounds really dire for even within our lifetime now. I'm sorry, I'm like, no ice in a couple of years?
No ice, no polar bears, no...
And then we gotta hear, oh great, we'll just adapt, but it doesn't seem to be any adapting when it keeps heating up like this.
Well, the funny thing is, these people who say that we're going to adapt don't realize what the evolutionary timescale is, Sandra. It takes a long time to adapt as a people to living in water again.
Mm.
I mean, if you look at the globe and you figure out how many cities are at risk, Jesus, Athens, Cairo, Alexandria, anything on an estuary, London, Miami is underwater, will be underwater, Philadelphia, New York, Boston. San Francisco.
I think that it's interesting that, you know, England is becoming, you know, a major market for champagne. Hello?
Yeah, you mean just, right, just...
For grapes. They're growing grapes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, grapes. Anyway, no, all of it just, it just seems to be a real kind of, I just think, you know, this generation... All these people are going to be, yeah, history is not going to bode well. And Obama, he really is going to be, I mean, he has two young kids. I don't understand. I really don't get it.
Maybe they've got tickets to the Logan's Run Bubble Dome. I don't mean to be a smart aleck, but either they're in complete denial or they think that, well, look, the plans are already afoot, for instance, like I've mentioned before. Some of the best ground for a rising sea level in the Miami area, poor folks live on it. And, you know, the APCs with the up-armers and the little dronies, and yeah, they'll come in and, you know, there'll be some ethnic cleansing when it comes time. Because Rush Limbaugh ain't going to leave his mansion without having somewhere else to go, and the somewhere is generally occupied by poor folks.
No, I understand, but I got the impression from what I've read is that the climate will get so unstable that those dreams of, you know, moving elsewhere will be kind of problematic, because if you have, let's say we're now like 150 years from now, if you have areas that are like where they used to be 80 degrees are now 140, which means, you know, a person can't survive.
Right.
Around the equator, so you have mass migration elsewhere. But I read that that because you had such a dramatic change, everywhere is unstable, even if the temperature is livable.
Yeah, and I mean, look at where we are in Appalachia. You would think that would be prime ground. You know, we're high ground above the water, above sea level, and everything. But lo and behold, everything around us is poison.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, yeah.
Yeah. So, congratulations.
Well, anyway, I mean, I don't know. I just am sort of kind of in awe.
Well, there's a question that attends all of this that I think none of us really want to contemplate. But I'll go ahead and ask it. What happens when it gets so bad And these oil conglomerates continue to refuse to deal with reality and continue to insist on ruining our lives and continue to insist on killing people. Is there some point where the people themselves rise up against the companies themselves?
Oh, I don't really know. I mean,
and at that point, will they have their own, like, Blackwater army to respond with?
Well, isn't that Nigeria right now? Shit.
That's my point. And, you know, I remember being at the Bank of America shareholder meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina last spring, when, you know, the guy two seats down from me had a peacemaker under his sport jacket in case I got uppity.
Nice. Well, no, I mean, I think the business as usual also attends the whole geoengineering crowd, which is also disturbing. Their main reasons for using geoengineering is to maintain the infinite economic growth model. So that's a worry. You know, let's fill up the ocean with a bunch of lime and hope that what? The shells don't disintegrate like they're doing right now.
Oh, Jesus.
So, I mean, you know, it's all a bit disturbing to me.
And understand that grape growing in England ain't going to last if the
if the
Gulf Stream gets nice and chilly.
Oh yeah, there is that. I mean, anyway, I don't know. I don't really know. And I guess I'll just sort of change the subject because it is sort of at on one level a bit overwhelming and kind of depressing. So I'll just go to something that's not as depressing, but. You know, maddening. Goddamn Notre Dame.
Oh, you forgot to say shallow.
Oh, shallow, yes, yes. You know, that pissed me right off.
Well, Lane Kiffin is not a football coach. I don't know what he is, but a football coach he's not. Wasn't that cute with time running out where he ran the same fade route into the end zone and got two really cool pass interference calls that advanced the ball exactly one damn foot?
Oh, no. I was at work. So I was listening to it on the radio. So.
Yeah, you know, half the distance to the goal. Half the distance to the goal was a foot. So he calls it again. And, you know, another half a foot. And still can't put the ball in the end zone. Turns it over on fourth and nothing. And so, you know, the ongoing elevation of Notre Dame continues. So now,
who are they going to play?
Now this is where it gets interesting. This Saturday they will have the Southeastern Conference Championship in Atlanta. The Georgia Bulldogs, who got their doors blown off by LSU, will square up against Alabama. If Alabama wins, Alabama's in the national championship. If Georgia wins, they're going to scream that they should be in the national championship. But you've still got Oregon out there, and you've still got Kansas State out there. You know, one of the things that drives me crazy about just automatically putting Notre Dame into the national championship is the fact that they're not playing the extra game that Oregon will play, that Alabama will play. No, because they're too damn good to be part of a conference. Well, I mean, they're willing to be in a conference in basketball because, you know, it's not the big deal that football is. But they got that football revenue from NBC, and they're not going to share it with no damn body. And so they play a 12-game schedule that they set themselves. They don't have to have any, they have no conference affiliations that they have to fill out. And they came near to having their rear ends handed to them by Pitt. Lowly freaking Pitt.
Right, but they got the market share of the ratings was off the chart, though, Bob, for that game.
Oh, yeah.
It was crazy. So, you know.
Well, I mean, you had the L.A. market. I mean, and, you know, the Notre Dame fan base is national. It's not.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, and, you know, the ratings in New York and everywhere apparently was like.
So the money boys and the bookies are just happy as a clam because when it comes to playing for the national championship, having Notre Dame in it, you know, that's probably a money doubler, if not trebler.
Anyway, so.
But I'm in hardcore full on roll tide mode.
they've beaten Notre Dame one time in six tries. But that none of that has happened since Nick Saban got hold of the athletic program there.
Well,
yeah, he's not a nice man. He's nobody that you would want to be your granddaddy. You wouldn't want him to be your dad. You wouldn't want him to be your kindly old uncle. He's a prick. And the only thing he ever thinks about is winning football games. And so if anybody can give these overrated Notre Dame players a comeuppance, he's the guy.
No, whoever they play, you know. But anyway, I just thought,
No, I understand. I'm hoping we will be home in time on Saturday for me to sit there and watch the SEC championship. And if Georgia wins, I mean, they'll have to take my belt and shoelaces.
Oh no, that's funny. Well, listen, I'll let you go, but I have to mention this thing, which is yet another subject. That whole Dick Durbin speech that he gave. I guess he was at the Progress for one of those liberal think tanks. But he said this. He said, he's talking about the fiscal cliff. He said, we can't be so naive as to believe that just taxing the rich is going to solve our problems, adding that his caucus needed to be open to issues painful and hard for us to talk about.
Well, and that comes down to something that I saw written somewhere, maybe on the Esquire blog, that we need to come to terms with the fact that the Republicans cannot do a damn thing to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. The only people who can harm Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security are the Democrats.
Right, but when I hear stuff like that, you know, I'm like, well, what do you, you know, you don't, it's just disgusting. The whole idea that they are even entertaining any thought. Apparently, Social Security is becoming more and more off the table in this go around. And I've heard that the whole idea of raising the age for Medicare is becoming too problematic because it's going to crash into his wonderful Affordable Care Act. So I'm not too sure, you know, but I don't like the language. I don't like the coordinated messaging coming out of the White House. It's just all coordinated right now. I see the black media coming out with just ridiculous information. So it's a bit of a worry.
Well, it's a lot of a worry. We don't have a Medicare problem that can't be solved, Sandra, by trimming, you know, by the change that falls into in between the sofa cushions in the Pentagon.
Well,
we don't have a Social Security problem at all.
Well,
and Social Security could be rendered solvent forevermore if they would drop the retirement age by 5 years and lift the cap on and let it include every single dime made by every single person, not just up to $106,000.
Well, and also with Medicare, all they need to do is let the government negotiate for medicine. That would
there's that
huge. I mean, you know, so if we want to fix it. It can be, but these third-way neoliberal Democrats are really dangerous. And Durbin is a direct mouthpiece for Obama. Believe that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's his voice in the Senate.
So when they sit down to start talking about that's my objection. They don't talk about whether to screw us or not. They talk about how much to screw us. You know, when
right,
this, When the Lindsey Grahams and the Saxby Chambliss's who was the other one, come out and start talking about how they're going to tell Grover Norquist to shove it, but then start talking about entitlement reform.
Yeah.
You know, they're just lying.
Well, not only that, but see, the only uptick with this is that the Congress is really... You know, the Boehner, he ain't got control of that. Those crazies there. So there's a good chance that they won't come to an impasse. I mean, the best thing that can happen is for January 1st to come and go and this not be resolved.
Yeah.
But
that's why Pierce refers to it as a gently sloping fiscal incline.
Yeah, well, it's just manufactured sort of Naomi Klein kind of shock doctrine shit, really.
Yes, it really is.
It's not necessary. Yet, I think that the public is pretty much aware of the endless bailout. So it's a real hard sell to tell people that you have to get rid of or bother the entitlements, because they've all seen the money flow to the banks. So I think the biggest problem that Obama's going to have is trying to show how it's necessary to cut programs that keep people out of poverty. I can't wait to hear that argument.
The problem is, one, if the clown's inside the Beltway, I'm inside the Beltway right now, get hold of it and declare it the second coming of Frisbees and Wheat Checks, you know, they create their own reality.
Well, did you happen to
catch Pierce writing about Maureen Dowd's column about RG3 and the Skins?
Oh God, what did she say?
Oh, she's got this whole thing where she's comparing RG3 to Barack Obama, and you know, calling his man, you know, calling Obama's manhood into question. Jesus, God, it's astonishing.
She got some, I'm sorry, that chick got kind of, she got issues with, dudes. Man.
Oh, and she refers to him as Barry Obama, you know, because that's so cute and so professional, right? No, I mean, Pierce just eviscerated her.
Well, remember how she was so freaky with Clinton? She has issues.
Oh, no, there's a beautiful passage here where she says, while Obama prefers to preen as the man alone in the arena, keeping other poles at a distance on stage, parsimoniously handing out thanks and failing to mention his party or top surrogate Bill Clinton in his last victory speech, RG3 never passes up a chance to share credit. You know, they pay her probably $1 million a year to write this crap in the New York Times.
Man, she's as bad as Friedman.
Oh no! At this point, she's gone. She's overworking the Peggy Noonan side of the street.
Oh no, that poor bitch.
But the beautiful part is Charlie Pierce's response to that passage I just read. He said, "Does the president lack an ethos of hard work and discipline?" Dowd doesn't make this argument because even she knows it's insane, so she just leaves it lying there for someone else to pick up. And her sudden devotion to Bill Clinton is touching, if a bit stalkerish. He's not going to call Mo. Get over it.
Oh, God. Oh, man. You know? Wow, I mean, all those writers, they need to get help, because David Brooks is out of control.
Oh, and how do you pronounce that? D-O-U-T-H-A-T?
No. You know, he's going to be found in a bathroom stall. Wait. Watch. He got problems.
Did you see?
Oh, my God. I know you talked about.
Yeah, did you see the reference that Pierce had referring to him as having a D'Artagnan wannabe starter kit beard?
Oh, shut up. No. He has issues with women, and he's strange. He's a weirdo, that guy.
Oh,
wait for it. He's going to be doing, remember that that English fool they found running out of Central Park with meth?
Yeah. No, I mean,
he's on TV again, the newsman. Anyway, yeah, that guy, something's going to happen to him. It's hilarious.
And I mean, here's another passage where she writes, "When Bill Clinton called and asked if he could have my vote, I was more prone to do it because we had developed a rapport. She's quoting a Democratic senator there. And then she says, "Let's hope that as Barry watches Robert, he'll learn that stunning opponents with big plays and then building on that excitement can energize his teammates, scare his opponents, and lead to big wins." And Pierce just says, "There are many ways to call the president lazy and or uppity. I much prefer John Sununu's direct approach to this sotto voce mumbling from the end of the bar."
Yeah, no, wow.
She's twisted.
That You know, the re-election of this man is the tipped all them people over the edge.
Oh, no, they're gone nuts. And by the way, you got an amen from Andy there out not in your neck of the woods. He says, F you, Senator Dick Durbin, F you. He says, think again, Jack. Yes, Dick, a 100% top marginal tax rate starts solving our problems.
Oh, my God. I mean, ain't that the truth? I mean, even if they went back to the rates before Reagan, it would be a big start. But anyway, we're in different terrain now. I don't know what's going to go on, but you got to stay on top of it, Bob. Anyway, I got to go. I have to correct the 3-paragraph essay.
Oh, dear. Well, get with it. Be gentle with the red pen, Sandra. Be gentle.
Oh, yes. Okay.
All right.
Good evening.
Bye now. Our good buddy Sandra calling from California. It is 2 minutes before the hour. We're going to take a top-of-the-hour break and come back. This is Conversation Radio on America's listener-supported progressive voice, America's listener-supported progressive conversation. This, in fact, is the horn, and you can get into the program. Don't call during the break, but right after the break ends, fire it right up on Skype. The handle is Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, horn. This is the horn, and as a matter of fact, I am Bob Kincaid.
I'm a traveler of all time and space. Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Yes, indeed. 6 minutes past the hour, 6 minutes past 8 p.m. here on the East Coast. This is The Horn. This is HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. I'm Bob Kincaid. A little something we call conversation radio. We're doing all of our conversation over Skype these days because, well, the Agnes is here with me at AIC headquarters in Washington, D.C. So are Ferd and Margie. So Agnes can't remotely produce with the phones from back at the home studio, and hence the other occasional little screw-ups that we have experienced. Well, they are entirely and absolutely mine. No one else's. I hear Agnes laughing in the background. I'd never blame Agnes anyway because I like, you know, I like this planet. An update. Many thanks. Many thanks to Gary, who started us off this evening with his challenge. It has been met. And so that is a huge help. And Gary, the words cannot express what it means when the listeners to The Horn step up and help keep The Horn going. And thanks to those who met Gary's challenge. Folks like E. Kofer and Faith and Jack. And with that understood, I have another email to share with you. This came in from our buddy Paul in Portland. Paul really wants to see us finish the month and be able to at least beat the Swede. You may recall Paul has communicated with the program from time to time over the years in the course of his studies and working on his degree. He graduated. He has his degree. He has gone out into the working world. And even though it would seem terribly unlikely at this point in time, given the way the economy is and the world for students coming out of academic programs, Paul, who is obviously really, really sharp, got work. And a company recognized the expertise that he would bring to their efforts. So Paul sent an email this evening. The subject line was, First Paycheck Challenge. He says, I've been working hard at my new job for about a month now, and I get my first paycheck on Friday. I want to make an end-of-the-month challenge. From this evening, from this moment, until Friday, at the end of the showtime, I will match up to $200 to help The Horn keep going. It is nice to finally be a regular contributor to The Horn, and I'm glad to finally be able to put up this challenge. Hope you all had a great Thanksgiving. Thank you immensely, Paul. Thank you immensely. Because the way it works out, we will beat the Swede and meet the $2,500 goal if Paul's challenge is met by close of program Friday. Again, thank you, Paul, and thank you to all of you who respond to this. Now, going back into the email bag, a couple of things. This issue of whether atheism is a religion or not, won't seem to go away. And we had a note from our buddy Philip. He said, I hate to be snarky. Oh, dear. When Philip says he's going to be snarky, you know, hide your children, hide your wife. I hate to be snarky, but Tom Hartman's show is chiefly a vehicle to sell his New Age books and receive accolades from the callers during the 50 seconds he allots them.
I listened to him for a while, but became smothered by mediocre political philosophy, efforts to equate atheists to religious fanatics, and redundant accounts of all his travels and successful business ventures. Sure, he's a really great guy. The problem is that he thinks so, too, and wants to tell everyone so they can acknowledge it. Sorry, Tom. I'm not so desperate a progressive that I have to listen to what amounts to an infomercial for Hartman Enterprises. Oh, Jesus, Philip. Some hosts use calls as a means to display their allegedly profound knowledge and elicit praise from callers. Oh, wow. Philip, in his second paragraph, says, "Then again, there's this hillbilly from West Virginia who's actually interested in what the callers think. A strange concept indeed, but it seems to work. I have to keep this short. I lost my agnostic Bible several days ago and haven't been able to pray doubtfully since, so I need to find it or my soul or lack of soul or it may or may not be in jeopardy. Keep me or don't keep me in your prayers. I'm not really sure it matters," says Philip. Tamara, writing from San Diego, responding to the story of the shooting in Florida. Jesus. She said, "Well, it's not just Florida. This guy didn't want to bother the cops on Thanksgiving, so he waited 2 days to report the fact that he shot two people." And what she's referring to, Tamara, is a story. Oh, my God. Byron David Smith, arrested for alleged murder of Hailey Kiefer and Nicholas Brady, teenaged cousins. Dateline Little Falls, Minnesota. A Minnesota homeowner who shot two unarmed teenagers in the midst of an apparent Thanksgiving Day break-in told authorities he feared they had a weapon but acknowledged firing more shots than I needed to. Well, you know, pity stayed his hand. "It's a pity I've run out of bullets," he said. And appeared to take pride in a good, clean finishing shot. That's a quote. A good, clean finishing shot for one teen, according to investigators. Byron David Smith is 64, white and terrified, and he was charged Monday with two counts of second-degree murder in a criminal complaint that was chilling for the clinical way investigators said he described the shootings. Smith told investigators he shot 18-year-old Hailey Kiefer, or maybe Haley, several times as she descended, Haley, as she descended a stairway into his basement, and his Mini 14 rifle jammed as he tried to shoot her again after she had tumbled down the steps. Though Kiefer was already hurting, his words, she let out a short laugh, Smith told investigators. He then pulled out his .22 caliber revolver and shot her several times in the chest. His response? "If you're trying to shoot somebody and they laugh at you, you go again." Yeah, because, you know, that's what it says in the Bible. He was also charged in the death of her cousin, 17-year-old Nicholas Brady. He said, naturally, Mr. Smith, pasty-faced, doughy Mr. Smith, that he was afraid the intruders might have a weapon. Somehow I don't think this is going to show up on the latest bulletin from Lake Wobegon. The sheriff of Morrison County, Minnesota, Michael Wetzel, said the law doesn't permit you to execute somebody once a threat is gone. His home is a remote home in a place called Little Falls in central Minnesota, a town of 8,000 people. He reported losing thousands of dollars in cash, gold coins, two guns, photo equipment, and jewelry. And he was afraid of what? That they were coming back? Huh? And here's the capper. The shootings happened on Thursday. But Smith explained that he didn't call the sheriff's department until Friday because, and this is a quote from the investigation report, he didn't want to trouble us on a holiday.
young Nicholas Brady, the 17-year-old. Smith said he fired when Brady came into view from the waist down. After on the stairs, Smith said he shot him in the face as he lay on the floor. "I want him dead," the complaint quoted Smith telling an investigator. He says he dragged Brady's body into his basement workshop, then sat down on his chair. After a few minutes, Kiefer began coming down the stairs, and he shot her as soon as her hips appeared. After shooting her with both the Mini 14 and the .22 caliber revolver, he dragged her next to Brady. With her still gasping for air, he fired a shot under her chin up into the cranium and described it as, quote, a good, clean finishing shot. You know, you got to lead him a little bit. John Lang is Smith's best friend and said, "You have a right to defend your home. He's been through hell." Now, let's back up for a minute. I'm not going to go over the ground again. Once is plenty. But remember that this pasty-faced, doughy old white guy has been charged with second-degree murder. Let that sink in. Second-degree murder in almost any jurisdiction is murder that is committed in the heat of passion. Two people are fighting. One pulls out a gun. The gun is fired. Somebody dies. You can make a credible argument for heat of passion murder. There's second-degree murder. It usually carries something less than a life sentence. First-degree murder, however, is murder that occurs as a result of the killer having engaged in some sort of premeditative conduct. There's enough time that passes for you to think, maybe I ought not do this. And you do it anyway. First-degree murder is the kind of murder that happens when you lie in wait. When you ambush somebody. When you plan it out with cold calculation in advance. In fact, if second-degree murder is what we understand to be heat of passion murder, first-degree murder is the murder that we refer to as cold-blooded. How in God's name is this not first-degree cold-blooded murder? He dragged one victim to his workshop and sat down to make sure he was good and dead, and then laid in wait for the young woman to come in and started shooting as soon as he saw her hips. Yeah, never mind that whole whites of their eyes thing. Now, it's Minnesota, so we can't be for sure. Anybody want to put some money on a skin color of the victim's test? A little wager? Yeah, me either. The crazy, violent, terrified, paranoid white people have declared open season. And the National Republican Rifle Association and Gun Owners of America, you remember Larry Pratt, have answered, "Yep, sure is. Shoot 'em if you got 'em." Dear Lord. Now, granted, at 64 years old, a 20-year sentence might be a life sentence. But it is a matter of what the jury finds. It needs to be understood that this man laid in wait for the young woman, premeditatedly killed her, and Marty, working along those lines, he says, doesn't murder one also require malice aforethought? No, this is not by any stretch of the imagination voluntary manslaughter, Marty. Manslaughter involves negligence, the doing or failure to do of something that the reasonable, prudent person would do or not do in similar or in similar or identical circumstances. And when the victim is laying on the ground on the way out, you don't finish the job by putting the muzzle under their chin and blowing the top of their skull off. That is not negligence. That is intentional conduct with malice aforethought. My God. Welcome to America. Jim asking, why were these folks in his basement or on his property initially? Please explain. Thanks, Jim. We don't know. They may very well have been burglars. But we don't know. We do know, however, that when he shot them, he ended any threat to himself. He incapacitated them. His right to self-defense ended long before he put the muzzle of the gun below the young woman's chin and blew the top of her skull to kingdom come. Want to bet an all-white jury lets him walk? Sweet God Almighty. But that's the deal with the devil we make. Remember what Gabby Gifford's husband said a couple of weeks ago at the sentencing of Jared Lee Loeffner about feckless politicians who lack the courage to engage in a dialogue about this country's bloodthirsty obsession with firearms? Yeah, this, I'm afraid, is that. And then some. It's about 24 minutes past the hour. If you want to get involved in the program, this would be a lovely time to do it. We're working by Skype only this week. If you have never set up a contact with me, just send a friend request to Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, H-O-R-N, on Skype. I will promptly accept it, and you'll be able to call in at your leisure. If we're already friends, go ahead and dial right up. We got last night's problem solved by signing out of Skype on one of the extra devices. I guess it creates a sort of conflict when two are cooking along at the same time. No, there's certainly plenty left for this Titanic Tuesday. And many thanks to the people who are responding to Paul in Portland's week's end challenge. I think we've got about $50 of his $200 challenge met at this point in time. Thank you very, very much. No, I had a big stack for Titanic Tuesday. And just as I pointed out in the first hour with that little loop of racism and mayhem and murder, it seems there are some things that this world, not just this country, cannot get over. One of the things we apparently cannot get over is our urge, or the urge of some of us, toward, and there's no other word for it, fascism. There are people in this world who have a taste for it, who did not learn the lesson of Benito Mussolini swinging upside down from a light standard in a Milan, Italy gas station parking lot, which is the natural, logical, and necessary end of all good fascists. Yeah, that's peaceful little me saying that. Gotta have some standards. While I was in Germany last spring, I saw the rise of the new German Nazis, who hate Muslims and, well, who hate everything. They're a hateful bunch. Isn't it funny that we had that audio on the program last week of loopy old Pat Robertson, Marion Robertson, the former liquor supply officer of the Korean War conflict, complaining that atheists are the miserable people who want to take everybody's happiness, when in reality the ones who are like that really are the fascists? But Marion does a little business with fascists and fascistically oriented people from time to time, so don't look for any correction to come out. The golden dawn is on the march in Greece, in aching, bleeding Greece. And they are as fascist as the day is long. And the fascists are on the march also in Hungary. There's a political party there, recognized, above board, everything, called the, I don't know if you pronounce the J as a J or a Y. I'm guessing Y. The Jobbik Party. And they're about as far right as you can get, and without coming all the way around the planet and winding up on the left. Martin Gyangyosi is a member of the Jobbik Party. And he recently declared that he wants a government-created, quote, list of Jews who pose what he calls a national security risk. Really? Yeah. In 2012, they're still out there. And they're not just loopy, poor spellers with shaven heads in Germany and the United States. Reuters reports in an article datelined today that Gyangyosi, a leader of, by the way, the Jobbik Party is the third most powerful party in Hungary. By the way, while we're out here, everybody who's real fond of third parties, raise your hand. What do you think the chances are that if we had a multi-party parliamentary system in the United States, at least the second or third most powerful party would be a bunch of godforsaken fascists? You know, I'm talking about with the spiffy uniforms and the goose-stepping and everything. Want a bet? I wouldn't take the bet. Yeah, he's a leader of the third most powerful political party in Hungary. And he said, because of the conflict in Gaza, Hungary needed to compile a list of Jews who pose a threat to national security in Hungary. And it's not like he just did this one time. Practically every time he opens his mouth, he's got something sleazy and nasty to say about the Roma people who are also citizens of Hungary. You know the Roma. Gypsies. And people just clap and clap when he says this crap, because as the third most popular party in Hungary, there's lots of people who agree with him. And yet, in reading through this Reuters article, written by, I am assuming, a real-life professional journalist by the name of Martin Dunal, the word fascist appears nowhere. Martin Gyöngyösi is 35 years old. He is the son of a diplomat. He grew up mostly in the Middle East and Asia, Egypt, Iraq, Afghanistan, and India. He apparently has a fetish for Iranian and Turkish souvenirs, fine by me. Trinity College in Dublin gave him a degree in business and political science back in 2000. For a while, he worked for the transnational, transglobal corporation KPMG. Before he went home to Budapest in 2005. In 2006, he joined the Jobbik Party, and he became their Member of Parliament in 2010. He's a Member of Parliament. And as a Member of Parliament, he stood up and he said he wants a list of Jews! The Jews! Next up, Protocols of Learned Elders of Zion. Some babbling about Rothschilds, perhaps. Gustav Zoltai is executive director of the Hungarian Jewish Congregations Association. He said, I'm a Holocaust survivor. For people like me, this generates raw fear, even though it is clear that this only serves political ends. This is the shame of Europe, the shame of the world. Just as a reminder, it's worth noting that somewhere between 500,000 and 600,000 Jews died in the Holocaust who came from Hungary. Yeah. You know what made a Member of Parliament Fascist Gyöngyösi so damn mad? Foreign Ministry State Secretary Zsolt Nemeth said the Hungarian people favored a peaceful solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Because the foreign minister said, such a resolution favors Israelis with Hungarian ancestry, Hungarian Jews, and Palestinians in Hungary. When he referenced that, when the foreign minister referenced that, Gyöngyösi said, I know how many people with Hungarian ancestry live in Israel, and how many Israeli Jews live in Hungary. I think such a conflict makes it timely to tally up people of Jewish ancestry who live here, especially in the Hungarian parliament and the Hungarian government, who indeed pose a national security risk to Hungary. The Jobbik Party posted a non-apology apology from this fascist, goose-stepping, monstrous freak. He said, man, he sounds like a Republican. I apologize to my Jewish compatriots for my declarations that could be misunderstood. See how it is with the fascist? It's always the offended party's fault. Yeah, it's the fact that they misunderstood what he was saying about needing a list of Jews in Hungary who posed a national security risk. It's their fault. Because they misunderstood. So, yeah, really, it is a non-apology apology. What a world, what a world, what a world. Kevin with an email saying, kind of goes without saying, but is that list in Hungary any different from a list here in America of Middle East Muslims who pose a security threat? Yeah, I get that, Kevin. Because it's kind of not. And then Jim noting in an email titled Notes from Nuremberg, my late Uncle Jack was a first lieutenant guarding von Ribbentrop, Adolf's foreign minister. Goering, Hitler's second paladin, stated statues would be erected to the 1946 prisoners. Go figure. Goering always had a touch of you know, even though he was a decorated World War I pilot for the primitive Luftwaffe, he had a great touch of the megalomaniacal about him. Yeah, Jim, the Holocaust Museum here in D.C. is on the list of things that need to be done while I have my family with me. Thanks for the suggestion. It is about 21 minutes before the hour. You know, we spent a considerable amount of time last night talking about the hellacious fire that claimed 121 human lives because fire extinguishers and unlocked doors would cut into the profit margins of the Bangladeshi 1% and their 1% enablers from other shores. So they had to lock the workers in and let them burn to death. Well, lo and behold, wasn't too awfully long before showtime this evening when I found another story. I think News Ninja Gene sent this to me. Diane Sweet, writing at Crooks and Liars, says, another fire broke out at a garment factory in Dhaka, Bangladesh, 2 days after a blaze at a separate clothing factory killed at least 121 people. The fire broke out on the third floor of the 12-story building, which houses four different garment factories. Some of the building's workers are trapped on the rooftop, are present tense, firefighters reported. Al Jazeera reporting also that some workers had been trapped on the roof by the new fire, but authorities said that although they were still searching the building, they believed most had escaped and there were no reported deaths. Well, that just makes everything all hunky-dory, doesn't it? We don't have any casualties, but the firefighters will search the building and see whether anyone has been suffocated, said Nisharul Arif, Dhaka Deputy Commissioner of Police. That fire came as about 15,000 Bangladeshis protested just blocks away from the building where the 121 souls died for global capitalism. Interestingly, the 15,000 who protested and demonstrated they were demanding justice for the victims. And they were demanding improved safety. About 200 sewing factories closed for the day after the protest erupted in Sevar, a suburb of Dhaka, the capital. They demanded justice. They demanded improved safety. Improved, not competent, just a little bit better. You know, maybe 2 fire extinguishers instead of none. Maybe 1 unlocked door instead of all of them locked. Because, see, that's the way improvement is measured in these parasitic business models based on capitalism gone global and run wild. Interestingly, the protesters were not taking note of the fact that they are being preyed upon by these transnational global corporations no less than a field of wheat is preyed upon by locusts. And I can't remember thinking back last night to Charlie Payne talking to some geek on Radio Rwanda, Fox News, saying, "Oh, I'm here to defend capitalism because capitalism is under attack." Poor, put upon, paranoid little. Is it attacking capitalism? Is that where we are? Is it an attack on capitalism to merely talk about the natural and rational consequences of capitalism's existence? Because this is that's what this is. This is capitalism at its very Milton Friedman-esque best. If there was one simple axiom that forms the core of anything that hateful old goon Friedman ever came up with, it is this: screw the workers, make the money. Leave the workers, take the cannoli. Saturday's factory fire had some follow-up. A survivor named Muhammad Ripu said yesterday that he tried to run out of the building when the fire alarm rang, but was stopped by management. Managers told us nothing happened. The fire alarm had just gone out of order. Go back to work. Mr. Ripu added, but we quickly understood that there was a fire. As we again ran for the exit point, we found it locked from the outside, and it was too late. Mr. Ripu survived because he jumped through a second-story window. Yamin said the fire extinguishers in the factory did not work, so these were meant just to impress the buyers or the authority. See, there's a whole substrate there. American companies care a great deal about their public image. Witness the grudging response of Apple to the fact that its workers' conditions at Foxconn in China had become so intolerable as to render suicide a better alternative than continuing to work making our gadgets. Not just Apples, Samsungs, Motorolas, yeah. And Apple responded by saying, "Well, you know, we've got a group that's going to go in now and monitor conditions." Well, they had one of those too. Let me see here. Let me check the checklist. You got any fire extinguishers? Oh, yes, very many. Show me the fire extinguishers. There is one now. There is another one on the next floor. Yeah, okay, I see that. How many fire extinguishers you got? Oh, we probably have 3 or 4 for every floor. Yeah, 12-story building, 48. Yep, that falls into code. Never once asking if they worked. Never once taking one of them off the wall, pulling the pin, squeezing the handle, and seeing if anything came out. Because, frankly, all they care about is checking off the boxes and, oh, we're a responsible corporation, you see. Oh, no, 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 they're not dying of brown lung before they're 14 years old. Heavens, no. Y'all got any dust masks? Oh, many, many. Ever use them? Every day. Meanwhile, having been told they're dust masks, he doesn't go downstairs to see the boxes of dust masks that are labeled 1991, that have never been opened. No, I'm not saying this happened in this particular instance. But if you think it doesn't, you don't understand global, transnational, predatory, parasitic capitalism. Because the capitalists of this country will kill anyone who get in their way, who so much as bite in to a stinking halfpenny of their profits. Their holy profits, their precious profits, their life-giving, lobster-buying, caviar-purchasing profits. You think I'm kidding? Consider this. There's this AstroTurf group out there called Fix the Debt. It's made up of a bunch of these silk stocking, lobster lunch eaten CEOs. Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein is a member of Fix the Debt. He said the retirement, he's the one who said last week, and we reported on it, that the retirement age has to be changed, and maybe we need to work till we die and just make it easy that way. Oh, there's several members of Fix the Debt.
They get together and they talk about those ghastly, ghastly poor working people who are ruining this country for the rest of us. It would be so nice if they would just sit down and shut up and work. But no, they want to retire. They want to go to the doctor. My word. Well, guess what?
There are 71 CEOs of public companies, publicly traded companies, that are members of Fix the Debt. Their average retirement assets are $9.1 million. Of these 71 CEOs, 54 of them participate in their company's retirement programs. And they have, those 54, collective pension assets of $649 million. That works out to about $12 million of retirement assets, pension assets, per CEO. If you work that out based on a age 65 retirement, that is enough money to generate a $65,873 pension check every month for the rest of their revolting lives. Compare that to the average Social Security check.
The average Social Security check is $1,237. But the Lloyd Blank finds of the world, we're going to have to do something about the retirement age. They are simply living too long after retirement. There are also individual company retirement accounts involved among the membership of Fix the Debt. 12 of them have more than $20 million in their individual accounts. Upon turning 65, if each of these CEOs converted their assets to an annuity, they'd receive a monthly check for at least $110,000 per month for life. But Medicare is killing America. It's destroying our budget. It's going to destroy our way of life. Pass me the lark's vomit canapes, would you please? I do hope the hummingbird tongue lady fingers come out shortly. They're so delightful this time of year. Lloyd Blankfein himself. Why don't they work until they die, Lloyd? Has $12 million squirreled away in, you know, what Tracy was talking about last night, you know, pin money. $12 million for retirement. While they're doing this, though, 41 of the 71 publicly held fixed-the-debt companies, 41 of 71 of them provide employee pension funds for their workers, and of those 41, only two have enough assets in their pension funds to meet their expected obligations. The rest have underfunded their worker pension funds by $103 billion. That's with a B, about $2.5 billion per company on average. But they see that the problem is us. And that's part of why I asked the question of Sandra that I asked earlier. I am nonviolent. I am a man of peace. But does there come a day when we finally realize that just about every problem we have in this country can be laid at the doorstep of parasites and predators like Lloyd Blankfein? What kind of life is he going to live between 65 and that merciful day on this planet when he breathes out and does not breathe in again, when he goes to his long home? What kind of life does he need that would give him $110,000 a year, a month? You know, we used to talk about Willard Romney having spaceship money. This is Logan's Run Bubble City money. There's a screwing coming, y'all. And you ain't getting the invites and the password to get down inside the bubble town. Capricorn 4321, carousel awaits. You know, there used to be that phrase you'd see on bumper stickers that said, eat the rich. That thing was cut off too short. Eat the rich before they eat you, because they're... You know, because you see, if you sat around with Lloyd Blankfein long enough, you would find out that he felt like his retirement was not wealthy enough. If he could just get his hands on your Social Security, he and those 71 other CEOs and executive VPs, then maybe they'd have enough to get by. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. So we have found our way to the end of this evening's program. Thanks for all the help that came along getting us toward the end of our fundraising period. It is much appreciated, as there are bills still to be paid. Thank you for the help with Paul's first paycheck challenge. I'm proud to tell you that we are $140 into matching Paul's challenge for $200 to help us make it to the Beat the Swede level. $60 to go. Wouldn't that be amazing if that happened tonight? And we were, and I wasn't talking about this for Thursday and Friday. Yeah, that would be cool. Thank you for your determination to see that independent, progressive dialogue, discussion, and conversation persists. Even when you can make an argument that the money folks would just prefer, and I mean by money folks, the ones with the walking around stuff like the Lloyd Blank finds of the world, would prefer that it didn't. Jesus, can you just see the blood draining out of that little bastard's face if he was to ever tune into the horn? Hello, Lloyd, prick. Yeah, me too. So our good friend Rick Smith is on the way next. We'll be back here. Like I said, it's a game time call. We may or may not be back here 6 p.m. Eastern time tomorrow night. I hope we are. But if we're not, you'll know that we had obligations outside the AIC headquarters related to our AIC work. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. First and foremost, you, who contribute your time, your energy, your funds, your goodwill, your thoughts, all that you contribute to make this the special thing that it is. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky in the chat room. Lottie, Sparky is also the moderator of the Horn Malloy late Friday night Skype group chat. Thanks, Sparky. Thanks to Agnes. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to our news ninjas, Jane and Susan. Thank you, John Fox, for all you do. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Ben is running the rerun stream in my absence. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. Like I said at the beginning of the program, go to AICACT.org and get involved in one of the most meaningful things you could ever do, helping to end the agony of Appalachia. AICACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.